Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 780. Let's talk about what's going on the Nerdist Community Corkboard. We have a few new shows on the podcast network. The Jackie and Laurie Show, hosted by Jackie Cation and Laurie Kilmartin. Friends of mine from the open mic days of all of us doing. Jackie Cation's actually the one that handed me Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, although she was quick to point out that the British version was the Philosopher's Stone. So many years ago, we were doing open mics together. I owe her a huge debt for introducing me to that world. They talk about their lives, current events, struggles, joys of being comedians. Also, the half hour happy hour with Allison Hayslip and Alex Albrecht. Two other good friends of mine. It's all just this is how people get on the network. Hey, I like you. You have a thing. Let's work together. Every week, Alex and Allison sit down with a drink and catch up with each other. Both shows will come out Mondays. Hayslip is one of my dearest friends from the old G4 days. And Alex, we became friends because of the G4 days. So there you go. Moving on to things that don't involve the Nerdist Network, Mark Iacolino writes, I'm a fan of your podcast. I've been listening for 2 years, mostly when working on my books. I have published 6 children's books, such as My Pet Penguins, Francis Dances, and more. You can find them by going to Amazon and searching Mark Iacolino. It could also be Iacolina. Iacolina, 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 Iacolina. Now go search Falco. It's Iacolina. Iacolina? What if the whole intro was just me trying to figure out Mark Iacolina's last name? Anyway, now you'll never forget it because I just said it probably the wrong way 9 times. This episode is Jason Alexander, who I met because he's a huge Walking Dead fan, and he came on Talking Dead, and he was super cool. And I said, will you please come on the podcast? And he was like, yes! So then we did it, and he continued to be super rad and cool. He's did a couple episodes of The Grinder, which just happened. And also, I know that Seinfeld just got released on a digital platform. What was it? Did it all come out on Amazon? I'm a moron. I probably should have looked that up. Anyway, there was a big pop-up shop for it here in Los Angeles, and there were lines out the door for hours long. So, Jason Alexander, good man, comedy legend Jason Alexander, and also Duckman, one of my favorite shows. So if you haven't watched Duckman, I will talk about it in the podcast, but go watch Duckman wherever you can find it. The precursor to a lot of contemporary animation comedy. Here's Nerds Podcast number 780 with Jason Alexander. Katie, roll the thing!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
So inappropriately dressed. I can't believe it. You did not walk across the lot.
Oh, it's freezing.
It's fucking freezing.
It is cold.
Damn, man.
It is real cold.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Better than most, not as good as some.
Yeah, it's good. Is Kyle coming?
Yeah,
he's
just went
to He's fetching me a quaff.
Oh, good. I'm going to tell him to fetch me one, too.
Quaff. Q-U-A-F-F. Yeah, that works.
We got it.
Yeah.
Kyle Clark. Okay. I have texted him. Send! Good. All right, yeah. We are done.
You get reception here. Wow.
Barely.
I thought,
being on the lot would have been a nice.
You'd think.
They've put you as far.
Is it, you know, you, yeah, we are literally the far corner of.
Why can't I just park outside this gate and hop it?
We should just, yeah, we should just be on Santa Monica Boulevard just out there shivering.
We should just put a chair out there. Yeah. Like in Boston when you shovel the spots, you put a chair in your
I like
spot.
It.
What?
We should just put a chair out there.
I don't know what that is.
You don't know that?
What do they do?
Oh, in Boston, when you're shoveling out your spot, and then you have to go get your car, so you leave like a folding chair.
And that's
in
your
the
claim
spot.
To the spot.
What, and someone can't just kick, someone can't just
they can, but it's Boston and it's heavily armed.
You won't get it. Yeah.
They won't stand for that. Yeah. So it breaks the code.
Are you from Boston?
Yes. Yeah.
I went to college up there.
You went to BU, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did too, briefly.
I didn't finish either.
Does anyone finish?
Howard Stern finished.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, Howard finished. Nice. And I have a doctorate from there, and he does not.
Oh.
That'll tell you everything you need to know.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was just in Cambridge performing at MIT.
Beautiful.
Lovely.
MIT is great.
Beautiful. You were right. Kyle was 20 feet away.
Yes.
I just texted you. I'm
Kyle,
sorry, Kyle. Will you please?
The best of
can
all
I please
men.
Have a decaf-y thing?
I can grab from the crafty.
Sure. Oh, it is. The coffee shop is closed.
I think they have decaf at
the fuck
this
are
is,
they do?
This is very fine.
It is good.
You will
all
like
right.
It.
Good.
You will
all right.
Like
yeah, whatever, Kyle. Whatever, whatever. Thank you.
Decaf's kind of a waste of time, isn't it?
No, I know it sounds like a waste of time, but I just like a hot beverage.
I know. I'm the same way.
I can't drink coffee. It makes me.
I gotta tell you.
Well, if you drink coffee, you can do five
thing
shows.
Ever. And is the now I, in September I had to change the entire way I live my ingesting life, but this is the one thing I did not have to give up, and it would have been the one thing I could not.
What did you have to stop doing?
Gluten, sugar, most fake sugars, most red meat, all shellfish, other kinds of weird fish.
Are you allergic to stuff?
No, he's kosher.
I have kosher. no, it was I was getting sick. I had all kinds of internal inflammation issues.
And it was just all that
and
stuff.
And they said, the guy, you know, I had just turned 56, and I went to the doctor, and he went, did you have fun? Did you enjoy those 55 years?
Oh, no.
That was a good time, wasn't it? He goes, well, that's done. So, and he basically said, you know, you can take me seriously or not, but if you don't, in about 2 years, you're going to be a really sick guy.
Oh, fuck.
So,
you have to. All right.
I'm going to give you about an hour to reflect. I'll be back in the office.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it is. But if you feel a lot better, do you feel better in general?
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
And the only time it's hard is, and I'm sure you hit it too, is you travel and you go, oh, Mr. Airplane, can I have anything that isn't wheat laden?
Right.
Or, you know. Other than that, it's okay. Or I play Podunky Towns sometimes, so I don't do a real dinner before I go on, and then I'll finish my show, and it's like 10:30 at night, and you want dinner. And you get back to the
Taco
hotel,
Bell.
And you go, salad? Well, that's an iceberg wedge, you know,
right.
Which is just covered.
Right.
It's just, it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, but then the responsibility is like, well, then you better start, then you got to plan your meals.
Yeah. I know people that travel with it. I'm not quite there yet.
You would have, you ultimately, if you kind of have to. So have you fallen off the wagon at all in terms, no, not at all. No.
Good
can't,
for you.
Can't do it. Can't do it. Wouldn't be prudent. No, it.
Dropping some church lady.
Yeah. No,
well, he was dropping George Bush.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, that
was Harvey.
Get my Carvey.
1,000 points a night wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Because carbs for wheat for me is like alcohol to an alcoholic. I do it and I go, gotta have more.
Gotta have you just
gotta
more, more, more.
Gotta have more.
But now that you've distanced yourself from it, are the cravings gone?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. I think the body ultimately adjusts to whatever you.
Yeah, and my wife lives this way, which is great.
That's handy when the other person.
But yeah, now you can. Yeah. I can walk into a a French pastry now and go, it's all poison.
That's good that she's not just scooping out a jug of gluten. Like you can't eat this, you pussy. Yeah, like why?
She's not that. My kids are. But
oh, your son. By the way, your son, the son that I met at Talking Dead, is his name Gabe.
Gabe. Yeah.
So cool.
Well, he's going to invite you probably can't come, but I have at the end of this, I'll invite you to his thing. He and his partner have been really quickly rising up through the sketch comedy ranks in town, and they have their first show at the Comedy Central stage.
That's fantastic.
On Wednesday night, and he said, oh, just invite Chris. I said, I'll invite him.
But, the only reason I can't go is because we shoot two shows
you
on
do
Wednesdays.
Two shows.
Yeah, we do our Thursday show Wednesday night, and so we don't get out here until like 10. But if he does another show in town,
he's a regular at IO West. Uh-huh. They give him the stage at least once a month. But I will.
He should do a show at Nerdist. I have a theater. We have a theater in Meltdown Comics.
I will, if you give me that info, I'll pass it on to him.
Done.
They are actually really funny.
So you don't have to. You don't have to do the parent like. No. I mean, it's a hard road, buddy. Like,
no. I mean, I don't know how you get anywhere with sketch and improv, but they are really funny.
It's good
they
training. Write
funny. You know, he did. We had seen 15-minute shows or 20-minute shows, and then he started doing hour shows. And he said, "Yeah, we're doing all new stuff." And I went, "Really? Well, that's ballsy because you're an hour of new stuff." You know? He did put up 14 sketches. 10 of them were home runs, first time up. So, wow.
That's fantastic.
And he does nothing. You know, he's funny. I guess I'm funny. But we do nothing the same way.
You know what that means? It means there's comedy in your jizz. I mean, I don't want to make it weird.
You have no idea how true a statement that is. I mean, they come out with little clown noses. I see little red dots.
It's broad. I'm glad you're inspecting it. Hang on. I just need to see. All right, the clowns are still there. What are you talking about? The other person's trying to sneak out of the building. I mean, I told you when you did Talking Dead, you've done a million things, but Duckman is one of my favorite things. Yeah. I fucking love Duckman.
Oh,
and I always hope that in the groundswell of like, let's bring things back, I always hope it comes
back. A lot of people ask about it. I don't know why it doesn't, because it really did fly under the radar. It was pre-South Park and pre-Family Guy and pre, you know, sort of the animated series for adults stuff. And it was on UPN, which, you know, the Paramount Network, which kind of came and went and had no money.
Yeah.
So it never really
Wasn't it on USA? I thought it was on USA.
No, originally it was UPN.
Wow.
And I know they released, we did 4 seasons. I think they released 1 or 2 on DVD. I don't know how well they did, but, you know, it's a funny show, very much ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Certainly animation style.
When you see, the Klasky Szupo, are they still, is Klasky Szupo still around?
No. As far as I know, they're not.
They did Rugrats, and they did, it was a very specific animation style.
Yeah.
And they had that building on, like, Highlander.
That's right. Yeah. That's where we used to put it together.
So great.
And Everett Peck, who created it, would come in every week. And, you know, it was great. And everybody involved with it, if you said, would you do it again for scale? We go, yeah, we had a great time. It was just a great time doing it.
So you were doing that. So that was, Seinfeld was.
That was all during Seinfeld.
That was all during Seinfeld, yeah. Nice. What a fun side gig.
Yeah.
I think when people watch it, if they haven't seen it before, they'll recognize, you'll see what other things it influenced. Like that comedy style, that
Absolutely.
Really quick non sequitur, you know, the stuff, but, you know, it's especially the relationship between you and Kornfed, like that.
Yeah.
A lot of that you see trickle down into other comedy, maybe you don't realize.
I think Matt and Trey were certainly influenced by it to some degree. And, it was what I marvel at when I go and look at one is how many pages got smushed into that 30-minute slot. Because we would do 48, 50-page scripts.
Yeah.
Wow. And you go, well, at a minute a page, this does not add up. But that dialogue used to fly. And it was just.
Did you guys record great. Together or individually?
No, hardly ever. We did. I think we did 2 episodes where I was in the room with anybody.
Because voiceover, when you can get the whole cast in, is the best.
It's the best.
You can fuck around.
But, you know, everybody was working on stuff, so.
So where? What is your background? Was your background sketch?
No.
What was your background? Theater.
I was a trained classical actor.
Trained classical theater person.
And I wasn't even particularly interested in comedy. When I went to college, I had done very little comedy. And I had 2 idols, 2 people that made me want to be a performer. One in the musical theater world was Ben Vereen.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I would be the next Ben Vereen. Why would that not happen?
Why not?
And the guy that I had my little man crush on was Bill Shatner. Because I was a Star Trek nut and I wanted to be Kirk. I didn't even want to be an actor. I wanted to captain the Enterprise. I thought that was a career goal. So those roles that Shatner's actually good in, you know, bigger than life. He's not good at playing a guy, but he's good at playing the head of Starfleet.
He's not playing a guy, but that guy.
Yeah, the guy. And that's the stuff that I gravitated towards. And I went through my first 2 years of college doing kind of that kind of stuff. And I had one professor. He was this wonderful African-American guy. He'd come up through street theater in the 60s. And he said, called me in his office. This was our, you know, first semester assessment. And he said, I know that your heart and soul is Hamlet, and you would be a profound Hamlet, but you will never play Hamlet. So you best get good at Falstaff. and I went, Falstaff. And he was telling me in no uncertain terms, if you want to have a commercial career, any kind of a, you know, a really viable career, you got to start looking at comedy. I was already losing my hair. I was always 20 pounds overweight. So, you know, he just looked at me and went, you've got a flair. You got the right energy for comedy, but you're not gravitating toward it. So, you know, make your choice. But you can be Paul Giamatti before there ever was a Paul Giamatti, or you can be George Costanza. So that's when I started looking at comedy, was in college.
Because the first time did Pretty Woman predate Seinfeld?
Yeah, just.
Barely.
Yeah.
They were around the same time.
Yeah. In fact, Pretty Woman, I think, is what led them to look for me for Seinfeld.
Got it. Because that's one of those things where where you haven't heard of someone yet, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, now they're just appearing in like the biggest things once.
Yeah. In fact, I won a Tony Award, then did Pretty Woman, then got Seinfeld. So it was like a big year.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So was the year before that not?
From the time I was 14, it's the one thing, because I talk to student actors all the time who go, what do I do when I get out of here? And I go, I don't know. I fell into a professional career at 14. I thought at 12 I started doing a lot of theater, just community theater, children's theater. By 14, I had picked up some professional representation. I was doing commercials, and I left college early because I was working. So all before Seinfeld, I was making. I never had another job from the time I left college. I never had to work at anything other than being an actor, and I was making, you know, a high five-figure income back in 1980, 81, just from commercials. Then I'd do a Broadway gig, add that to that. So I was making a great living, and all I ever wanted to do was New York theater. I had no aspirations towards film or television.
You did a McDonald's commercial.
I did a McDonald's commercial. The only McDonald's product that never succeeded. The McDLT.
It was. That was my guess.
Yeah. I was Mr. McDLT, and it was an extravagant commercial.
You keep the cool side cool and the hot side hot.
And the hot side hot, unless you put it into the bag on a vertical, and then it just becomes a clusterfuck. But it was, I had a 2-year deal with McDonald's. They made one commercial, the product tanked, and they went, thank you.
Oh, my God. I can't believe that DLT was buried in the back of my brain somewhere, just waiting to be picked.
Oh, man. What a terrible idea. What a terrible product. And I'm so proud to have represented it to America.
But you know what's so interesting is just for anyone, for any career path, particularly entertainment, is to hear, I started working regularly in 80 and 81, but it wasn't until 10 years later that everything...
Although I had a career that, 95% of actors would go, oh, I'd kill for that. I mean, I was working on Broadway. I'm working with great people. I'm, putting money in the bank every year. And then this thing... I always had this fantasy when I was a little kid. How you stand in the bathroom going, I want to thank the Academy. It was the Oscars. Mine was the Tony. I just wanted to somehow live long enough to win a Tony Award. Won it at 29. And I remember going home that night going, well, now what do I dream about? This is kind of weird. And within 3 months of that, Pretty Woman fell from out of the sky. And it was the Gary Marshall to Rob Reiner connection, Rob Reiner's company, did Seinfeld, and I think that's how my name got put in the hopper to be seen for Seinfeld, was because Gary said, I worked with this kid, he was good, he's not, you should look at him. Not a Jew, by the way. Gary Marshall, not a Jew.
Isn't
that's
it crazy?
The strangest thing
isn't
in the world.
By the way, that was teenage Gary Marshall.
Yeah.
That's how he's just always, he's always been that guy.
Absolutely.
My sister Penny.
The ball, you'll give it me to me.
Well, your character in Pretty Woman wasn't a particularly, he was just kind of the, he wasn't really a comedy character.
No, he was a villain, so the crazy secret about Pretty Woman that I think somebody else must talk about this, but Pretty Woman, the script was a really much darker movie than what we all saw. It was called 3000, and that's how much he pays her. And the depiction of life as a prostitute is a lot more real. She's a bit of a drug addict in the script. They don't end up together at the end. It was, it was a different thing. That's the script that I got hired for. When I got to the shoot on the first day, they'd been shooting for a couple of weeks, and Gear came up to me and said, get ready. I said, what? He goes, I don't know what movie we're making, but it's not the one on the page. And Gary had a different idea in his head. He saw this other sort of fantastical romantic comedy. And he didn't tell anybody. Because he didn't tell producers, he didn't tell anybody. And he would bring us out on the set, getting ready to shoot what we thought was, you know, my first scene, I think, was some business machination between Gear and myself. And we got out there, and he said, yeah, let's hear the words, say the words. And we start running the dialogue, and he goes, wait, when you come in, notice Richard's shoes. Say something about his shoes, because Richard had on a very fancy pair of shoes at that. And I said, okay. And we ad-libbed like six lines about Richard's shoes. And he goes, let's shoot it. and then we shot the shoe thing, and then we never shot the scene. So even the big scene where I attacked Julia, we did it 20 different ways. We did it where she beats the crap out of me. We did it where it isn't quite as serious as, you know, and he kind of just picked and chose the colors he wanted.
And they replaced drugs with dental floss.
Yeah, dental floss.
Because he ultimately sounded like he... Wow, that is so strange. So he took a dark indie and essentially made it a fairy tale.
Yeah. And, you know, we wrapped shooting. Everybody had a great time, because you always do on a Gary Marshall set. But we went, he's got nothing. There's no movie here. There's nothing. We never thought it would see the light of day. And then we heard, oh, they're renaming it Pretty Woman because we got the song. And I went, well, that's it. That's the death knell right there. And then we got invited to the cast and crew screening. And we all sat there with our jaws slack going, how the hell did he do this? He was using things where we didn't know the camera was rolling, or outtakes, or
oh wow,
all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, you know, there's that famous moment where they're going to the opera, and Richard's offering her the pearl necklace, right. And he snaps it shut on her hand.
Yeah.
Well, she didn't know the camera was rolling. If you watch, she laughs and looks right into the camera because she's like, oh, look what Richard did. You know. And so it's filled with stuff like that, and it was just he was just brilliant about cobbling together.
Oh my god! And it did at the time. I guess you just never know. It just shows that you just never know.
No, honest to God.
Because that really was the biggest movie of that year.
It was huge. I mean, at the time, it was historic, I think. It was a touchstone in Disney film. It was gigantic.
And it sent her into this to the stratosphere.
Well, that we did know. When we were on the set, we said, if this thing sees the light of day, she's huge.
Yeah.
Because she was so charismatic. She'd smile at you and you'd go, I'll kill people for you.
What do you want me to do?
Yeah,
I'll do whatever you want.
You're pretty. You're a pretty woman.
But then the same thing with Seinfeld, because Seinfeld is lore in the entertainment business for the state of the way things are now, where things get two episodes and everyone always goes, right. Well, if they, you know, using these metrics and this method, they never would have given Seinfeld a chance, right. Because the first season was not what the show ended up becoming. Is that true?
Well, actually, the first season is very much what the show became, but it wasn't making anybody happy. We did the pilot, and I remember at the end of shooting the pilot, Jerry said to me, so, what do you think? What do you think? I said, no. He said, you don't think it's good? I said, no, I think it's good. That's the problem. I said, the audience for this thing is me. You know, guys who live in a city, probably white, 18 to maybe 32 years old. That's the audience. But they're not watching TV. The number one comedy in America when we started was Alf. Okay? So... So I said, no one's going to watch this, you know. And initially, I was right. So NBC tested the pilot. It's the worst test results up to that point of any half hour they had ever made. And they said, no, we're not picking this up. It was dumped, dead. You're released. Go and be happy. Take another show if you want. And in those days, because there was only three networks in HBO, and a very new HBO. They would fill empty slots by just throwing on dead pilots. So they threw on the dead pilot of Seinfeld, and somebody, I think the TV Guide critic, wrote, wow, that was interesting and new and kind of fun. And they went, was it? that's not what our test. But NBC liked Jerry, and they knew it was funny. They just didn't think it worked. And somehow they called us all up and said, would you guys do a few more if we gave you the chance just to see? And we all said, sure. Added Julia. Did a whopping episode, a four order episode. Did those. They tested like crap too, and they threw them on. And it was weird that nobody was watching except this very small demographic that I described, guys 18 to 32 years old. Well, you know, ad guys love that audience. That's the one they're trying to get. So we could always sell the time, even though very few, the numbers were small. So if the network had just gone by the rating numbers, they would have tossed it. Instead, they just kept moving it around the schedule, seeing if they could find any more of an audience for it. And eventually they parked us after Cheers. And that's when we exploded. But that was deep into the third season.
Which is actually great because it usually takes a show like two or three seasons to really
Absolutely.
Lock in.
But you can see, even in the pilot, you can see the Seinfeld show. You see it coming. We're all figuring it out. But it's there. The style is there. The technique of doing these tangential comedy runs that are off story, very small story. The characters are all basically there.
It's interesting that you always it's right at the turn of a decade is usually the time when
something
people
happens.
Seem
yeah.
to be ready for it. It's like you said, Alf. Well, that was the end of the 80s,
right.
kind of, or the beginning of the 90s. Like,
Absolutely.
You know, Seinfeld ushered in this whole new type of
comedy.
But it was also, I think it was also, the 90s is really when HBO and Showtime started to come into their real stride. Because up until then, they were just taking whatever movies had tanked at the box office, or they get one or two good ones, and they had very little original programming.
Dream On.
Dream On was starting to break up.
Yeah.
You know? But they started to get aggressive, and all of a sudden, the more sophisticated audience was traveling over to cable.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, the network guys went, We have to smarten this up a little bit. Because, as you know, the trick in broadcast is greatest common denominator. Biggest crowd there is. Greatest common denominator. Don't offend. Don't challenge. Don't, you know. So to do that, you have to set the artistic bar a little low. You're being way too careful. And that produces things like Alf. Which is fine in its own right. I mean, you know, if I had a young family.
No one on Alf is taking offense to this.
Yeah, no, you know. But.
You know what, though? It's an interesting... Well, first of all, Spike Ferriston has been on before, mm-hmm. and he talked about... I mean, the writing process sounds so obvious. Like, why don't more people do this? But he said, yeah, you would go in and you would just pitch things that happened to you to Larry. And then that's where and that's why the show was so unique, is because you guys weren't writing for lowest common denominator. You were writing the complete opposite, the most specific,
right.
least common denominator.
And it had no agenda. There was no, I mean, we had one season arc where, you know, it was Jerry and George pitching the Jerry show to NBC. But other than that, you know, when the thing they never had to answer is what happens in season four?
Right.
We renegotiate for more money because it's season four. That's the answer. It's just funny. And, you know, I'm sure Spike told you, the big sign over the writer's door, it said, no hugging, no learning. It's not, the characters don't grow. They don't, you know, they just are who they are. And you go for the funniest spot you can find.
I mean, that really did, that was one of the things that kind of encapsulated the, you know, it's so funny because when you look at 70s sitcoms and 90s sitcoms, there's very much a cyclical, because in the 60s and the 80s are very similar with like the aw hug moment
sure.
type of sitcom. And then the 70s, you had Norman Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 80s and then the 90s, I mean, with the exception of James L. Brooks, most sitcoms were like Alf.
Absolutely.
And the 90s was very much, you know, about irony and, you know, like taking jabs and a lot of the protagonists started becoming despicable characters as opposed to lovable characters. I mean,
well, that's the thing. Larry and Jerry talk about how, you know, in the pitch meeting for Seinfeld, they got the inevitable question, why do we like these people? And Larry was like, you don't! Who gives a shit what you like? And it harkens all the way back to All in the Family. You can't redeem Archie Bunker, but there was something about him that we understood and forgave and embraced. There's nothing likable about Archie, really, on the surface. You have to dig down and hit some tender moments. But,
yeah.
You know, and yet they still ask these questions. Why do we care? Why do we like them? Well, in a comedy, you like them because they make you laugh. That's the only reason you need to like them.
Right.
If you relate to them, great. But if they're making you laugh, there's a lot of people, comics, that I love because they make me laugh. I don't relate to at all. So, yeah. You know, it's just a crazy question.
I honestly don't think – I think Seinfeld would have had a difficult time in today's social media climate with a lot of the stuff that you guys made fun of and tackled. And, you
sure.
know, there'd be a lot – I'm sure there would be – outrage, Seinfeld makes fun of blah, blah, blah,
well,
blah, blah.
Look, we stepped in poo on the Puerto Rican Day parade, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to do it. And actually, I don't even know if you could do the stories we were doing. Cell phones would have tanked Seinfeld. We always needed to be together to deliver our information.
I think it's very... I
always thought it was very fitting that in the last episode of Seinfeld, Elaine has the cell phone and they're talking about the walk and talk. I always thought it was a very fitting way to end the series. It was like, well, everyone, cell phones are around. We can't do the show anymore.
Yeah, no, it's really. It would have killed us.
Yeah.
So what was the experience like for you in terms of, were you bringing in story ideas or were you just like, yeah, I'll just, you know.
No. They made it pretty clear that they, in a very kind way, they weren't looking to me and Julia and Michael for stories. If we happened to, in the course of rehearsing or hanging out, told an interesting story, it could wind up as something. But we wouldn't go in and go, okay, this thing happened to me, let me just pitch it to you. No, never. The input they did enjoy from us is that the rehearsal week was pretty loosey-goosey. So if we thought of stuff on the set, a line, a bit of business, a story idea, that we could try. But by tape night, it was all locked in. People very flatteringly go, oh, you guys were ad-libbing all over the place. We go, no. If we said and it was but, we'd do another take. So, but it felt inclusive and loose getting there, but never as far as being invited to the writer's room to pitch it.
I mean, literally, the four of you all had long careers before that show came around. I remember watching Michael Richards on Fridays, that weird Saturday Night Live knockoff or something.
It's Bastard Stepbrother or something. Yeah, right.
Yeah, there was some weird, which I remember enjoying because the show was so surreal. I remember the show being really surreal. And then Julia had been amazing on SNL and Jerry had been around and you went around doing theater. So it's, you know, were you ready for when it finally, with all the stops and starts, when it finally popped, were you emotionally ready for it, or did it just feel like, you know, we'll just kind of ride this out for a while?
Well, you know, that's the really cool thing about the way Seinfeld hit, is that even if I were the kind of person who would have had a bad reaction to success, I had enough of it for long enough in my own little way that it wasn't going to get to me. And then the success of Seinfeld, if we had been Friends, because Friends debuted its first night and it was a giant hit, and that's where it stayed. That was not us. So we went into our final season going, I guess people are really watching this thing. I mean, it was always surreal. Jerry once described us, I loved his description. He said, we're the world's biggest garage band. We're just in the garage making noise. We can't believe the neighbors are going, you know, these guys aren't bad. So that's what it felt like. It felt like our little stupid project. And gradually but surely it started to hit with people. To the point where I'm still amazed. Like if I travel internationally to places where I go, I'm a face in the crowd. Nobody knows who I am here. And then they go, George, you know, in the Middle East. And I go, wow.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk that it would penetrate to here? So it was a nice, even, steady, slow build. And I don't think anybody had a significant ego change. We were all heinous people when we started. And we were heinous people when we
I mean, it was – you could not have been on a show at a better time than in the 90s, just for that whole lots of people were still watching network television.
Yeah,
salaries were still, you still had great syndication deals.
Oh my God.
Now, like, unless you're Big Bang Theory.
Right. No, it's
like,
it's,
no, it's, it, it is that, that is, that is talking about the old day, like the golden days. Ah, there was a time.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, there are times when people say to me, well, you know, what about Friends did better than you guys? And what about Big Bang's better than Friends, you know, doing better than Friends? And I go, yeah, but, you know, let's put it into perspective. I made more money playing George in 9 years than Alan Alda made playing Hawkeye for 12 years.
Wow.
So, you know, you're always standing on the shoulders of the guy that came in front of you.
Right.
You can't really get crazy.
Kelsey Grammer stands above us all.
Yeah. Right?
20 years being Frasier.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's still mind-blowing, too. It's like, I'm going to just be this kind of walk-on character, and then it's like, you just never know. You never know what the entertainment business is puzzling, but you should never close. Yeah.
And in fact, Seinfeld had two potential spinoffs that I thought they should have done, and they didn't do either one. The number one that I thought through the roof would have been the four parents down at the condo in Florida.
Oh, absolutely.
That would have been unbelievable.
And they never even,
I don't think they ever looked at it. And the other one that I thought would really have been timely was the Johnny Cochran character.
Oh, yeah.
That Phil Morris.
Phil Morris.
If they had made a legal comedy with him as the centerpiece, I went, that would be Absolute gold.
Did they ever talk about spinoffs on the show?
No.
I heard something once about a George spinoff. It never got. They never said to me, "Hey, if we did, what would?" They may have said something to Michael about doing a Kramer thing, but you know, I don't know what Michael's response was. I would have thought there's no George without Jerry and Elaine.
Right.
I mean, you got the parents, but it's really he only exists in juxtaposition to these other three guys. So. I don't think it would have worked.
When it ended, were you emotionally ready for that to be the end? Or really?
Yeah.
You were.
Yeah. This is a nice testament to Jerry. At around the Christmas break every year, starting around season six, we'd get together and go, "How are we feeling? Everybody feeling good about this? You know, feels like we're going strong." And we'd always say, yeah. No, it's going good. The season we stopped, we kind of came into that season going, I've got a feeling this may be it. But we got to the Christmas break and we had the meeting and we all kind of came in going, I think this is it. And for a variety of reasons, but the really responsible one was we felt like we couldn't surprise the audience anymore. That you kind of knew what these characters would do given almost any impetus or circumstance. That is a pretty good indicator you're done. If you can't get to the unexpected anymore, you can do funny, but if you can't do unexpected, I think that's you've probably done enough.
Yeah. Was there any part in terms of afterwards, did you have to fight any? They're like, I'm not George Costanza, I'm an actor and I can play a lot of different.
Professionally, I still fight it. So the two biggest things that I was a part of post-Seinfeld were two series of my own. One of them lasted very, very briefly, and the other one lasted one season. And neither one was, you know, an out-of-the-box. Neither one got a huge first look, and then the audience went away. So they were growing when they were canceled, but it was never a huge audience to begin with. So you've had now, how long are we done? 15 years of George out there 3-4 times a day, and not nearly as many images of me doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So even the industry at this point goes, yeah, he probably wasn't acting. That's probably that's who he is. I'm sure that's the guy. And most producers, it's not an audience problem. It's a producer problem. Most producers, for some reason, do not want to face the moment that will happen. If you put me in the Birdman, in the Zach Galifianakis role, when I come on for about 3 seconds, the audience is going to go, "Hey, it's George."
Fuck.
Now, if I do my job and they do their job, 3 seconds later, they're watching this character.
Right.
Producers don't want that 3 seconds. And they don't think, for whatever reason, that when Tom Hanks walks on the screen in Bridge of Spies, we don't go, "Hey, Forrest Gump."
You know? Hey, it's Tom Hanks.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we all bring our associations, but I think they feel like the audience has been glutted on this image of me and they can't get it out of their head and it's they don't want to take the time to blow the cobwebs away.
But you can do so. But you do. I mean, you do theater and you tour and you do.
Knock wood. That's me knocking. Come in. I've never stopped working, but it's on. It's for audiences that are nowhere near as big. So I do guest stuff on TV. I actually, because of this, I wound up doing 2 one-man shows that I tour all over the place. One's a stand-up comedy show, which I never was until about 7 years ago. The other one is a symphony show that I take with symphonies all over the place. So that's great. People see that stuff. And I do a lot of stuff behind the scenes. I do some more directing, some producing, some writing, some teaching. Life is happy. Life is good. Amazingly, it's still a very lucrative career, even without Seinfeld. But I have not found that thing that makes me go, yeah, let me just sign another 6 or 7 year contract. I haven't found that thing.
But you're
not even playing Tony Kornheiser, would you?
Well, that was the last one. But, you know, it's so funny. The one I did before that, Bob Patterson, was one that I co-created with my friend Peter Tilden. Now, Patterson didn't last very long, and it was universally reviled by critics. But I will go to my grave saying, that was a funny show, and that show had real possibilities. Yeah. I never thought Listen Up was was going to be solid, but you know, when I met with Les Moonves, he said, you know, I love you for this. I love this show. We waited a year to cast it. You're available now. I want you. I'll give you at least 2 years. And then, of course, he canceled it this season. But I never I thought it was Alf. I thought it was a fine, nice, sweet family show. I thought Malcolm Jamal Warner and I could have done something more than we were given. And there was a young actress named Daniela Monet who played my daughter, and I thought she was, you know, there was something there that we could have played. But that show never took off. Never
cut to the news tomorrow. Jason Alexander reboots Alf.
Like, yeah. Bring it on, baby.
There's a little Alf doll right in the corner right there. Like, you could already start practicing.
There is. Son of a...
Oh, man, that is freaky.
You summoned him.
Wow.
You've summoned him.
Holy crap. It's actually Alf. It's not just like a generic Alf. That's
no.
Alf.
No problem, Jason.
How did that... What is the fascination with that?
I don't know. Alf, you know, I was in high school when Alf was on, so I was the demo... It's funny. I watched every comedy, everything when I was growing. I was a voracious comedy consumer. Every stand-up, everything, every sitcom, whether it was HBO or family sitcoms and animation and everything. And, you know, Alf was just one of those. Because it's such a – to me, it's such a bizarre – I think the show wanted in the first episode to be edgier.
Mm-hmm.
They tried.
Yeah.
And then in the end, it was just like, well, you know, because they, you know, they tried to make him Stewie, basically. They tried to make him this sort of.
Sure.
I mean, they didn't know that's what they were doing, but he was that archetype. And then as it sort of went on, I think it just became like, oh.
Well, I'm sure there was also that moment where I remember auditioning for the voice of Howard the Duck in the movie Howard the Duck, which eventually went to my friendship Zion. And I thought, oh, what a cool idea. The script's kind of funny. How'd they do the duck? Thinking, oh, technology. It's a guy in a duck suit.
Yeah.
No, come on, seriously. How did they do it?
Like, is that why you went to do Duckman? Because you really.
I had to have a duck. I needed to have one duck on the resume.
You need to have one filthy, trash talking duck. Exactly. In your resume. It's almost Howard the Duck.
Damn close.
Ended up being Duckman. Yeah, but it, I think it was just that kind of. I was the right age for all of that stuff, wow. But I also watched edgy stuff, too. Like, I didn't really have any specific... I just watched everything.
Yeah.
Monty Python, British comedy, all British comedy, like, all of it. Sure. But it's very hard to do... You know, edgy comedy's hard because it's... That's why it's edgy. Like,
also, on television, it was nigh on impossible because edgy was going to turn some people off and no sponsor wanted
Alien
to turn off
their, 8.
Yeah.
Alien?
Yeah, safe.
Ow?
Yeah.
Alien 8.
And if he says something, you know, untoward, you go... He doesn't know any better.
He's just a puppet.
He's not from here.
He's not from here. I like that the network.
He's from Melmac.
I like that the network would use the fact. He doesn't know our customs. It's not his.
He didn't mean it.
He's not human. You know, you're marginalizing him by putting your.
That's right. Yeah.
Marginalizing was not a word we used in the
80s.
No,
like, not at all.
That's not at all. That's a recent addition to the vernacular, but at the time. I wish NBC would have just taken the hard line that he just didn't know our culture.
Yeah, that he wasn't.
You know, Paul Feig wrote an episode of Alf that we keep talking about doing a live reading of. Do you remember what it was about?
No, but I...
It was something really dark,
wasn't
it? It
was dark, like, so it? Dark. Like, I feel like there was suicide involved somewhere.
There was something so dark about it.
That sounds like a Larry Charles episode.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it almost... And Alf, every so often, threatens to come back, and then it doesn't quite come back.
Honestly, God, in post-Teddy, don't you think an Alf movie would kill?
Well, I think so, but then I kind of go, well, who would go see it? Because it...
Who wouldn't go see it?
I don't know, because it could just be one of those pop culture things that's just like... It could be Gem and the Holograms. Like, they would probably do it like Garfield, you know? Like, I don't know if they would do it
Didn't
the
they
way
do a TV movie not long ago that George Lopez was in?
Oh, did they?
Alf? Really?
Yeah, for ABC.
What they should do is just some weird indie... Like, why doesn't someone just... You know, if IP is just sitting there not hurting anyone, not bothering anyone, why not just do something super weird, do some bizarre, like, Pulp Fiction-esque... indie film with Alf, make it super fucked up.
Do a John Travolta with him.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure.
John Travolta, Alf. Why not? I mean, like, what
He's
do they
the
have?
Third Vega brother?
Project Alf was 96?
Yeah. Oh, wow. So that's not nearly as recent as I remember?
But it would have to be a totally different... I don't think they should try to do it on... Although, there was a really great Alf cartoon on NBC... There was a really great Alf cartoon that was the first time...
Oh, boy.
No, listen to me. It was the first time I'd ever seen self-referent... Like, outside of Warner Brothers, like old, like Chuck Jones, Warner Brothers, Bob Clampett, Warner Brothers. It was the first time that I had seen, like, a self-referential cartoon.
Uh-huh.
In the 80s, they were essentially making fun of pop culture in this Alf cartoon. It was surprising. Like, all the types of writing that you like. This is what these guys did. I'm not joking. I'm not kidding.
I believe you. You're an honest man.
I'll tell you right now. You get Simon Pegg to voice the new Alf.
Oh!
You make a new a Teddy version of Alf or Ted. Ted, you kill.
I would, but I don't know if I'm allowed to do that. I don't know if I can just
do anything. I don't think they're going to sit hard on the Alf property.
You know how
if you come up with Simon Pegg in a script, they may go, hey, let's give it a shot.
You know how IP is in corporations. Like, can I use that? No. But you're not using it? Fuck you. You know,
right.
It's just in a vault. You
absolutely
don't know where it is. No, you don't know where it is. You know, like, it's
right. They don't. I was at Condé Nast last week. I had a meeting over there in New York, and they were showing me the executive conference room, and I was talking to somebody from Wired, and I was like, do you guys ever do meetings in that room? Because it's like this beautiful room on the 35th floor of the World Trade Center. And they're like, yeah, I mean, we book stuff in there sometimes, but it's $1,000 to use it. I'm like, what do you mean? Who gets paid $1,000? Condé Nast. I'm like, but Condé Nast owns Wired. And they're like, yep. It's just how it works. We just spit the money back into Condé Nast.
You're describing the film business, too.
It's so fucking weird.
The
like,
film
the
business.
Money just is routed back into, guys, the shell game. I just wanted to talk about it.
When we were working on House of 1,000 Corpses with Rob Zombie, and the studio had a meeting with him to tell him that there was no more money, and he was like, but they catered it like $1,000 and then charged the production, and then I'm sure there was a charge for the room that they had the meeting. Like, it's a lot of like refunneled.
Studios are gonna make money. There's no such thing as a project that, well, no, that's not true. But I mean, I've had back end on most of the stuff in my career. I've never seen, other than Seinfeld, I've never seen a penny.
Yeah, because it's the same thing as like Back to the Future still in the red. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Really? Yeah.
I think Hanks once said that I think Forrest Gump was made for like $40 million something, and he had back end points. And domestic box office the year it came out was, you know, double that. And so years later, the story goes, he just went, hey, back end, you know, it's made $1 billion something. He went, yeah, no, it's still. Still in the red. We're almost there. Almost.
Yeah.
There.
This call cost $1 million
because of the fucking real estate they pay for Bubba Gump Shrimpco.
Somebody actually.
We need the Santa Monica Pier.
Somebody once said to me, you know, studios are corporations. They got to make the losers pay for the winners, or the winners pay for the losers. So
right.
All they're looking at is the stock price. There are no.
Yeah.
You can't get a, you know, Titanic. Nah, come on, never made it done.
What? No, no.
Did NBC ever send you guys like the old Porsche Boxster, like they gave?
No, let me tell you something,
Will and Grace.
you know, I'm not normally
Kelsey
a bitter
Grader
man.
Got that Viper over.
NBC gave us a breakfast
in a Boxster.
No, we hit our 100th episode, right, and we got. Which is actually kind of fun. They gave us remember I said the worst test results ever in the history of television for the pilot?
Yeah.
They gave us a plaque with it framed, the test results.
That's pretty great.
That's pretty funny. That's, and you go, okay, that's nice. And then 3 years later, Will and Grace hit 100, and they get a Porsche. everything changed overnight. Where was the ass-kissing for the Seinfeld group now?
You sound like George with the Ted Danza spot and the plane.
It's so true. No, NBC, no, I will tell, oh my God. You want to hear the worst thing I ever did?
Yes.
So I think it's well known. We had a rather contentious renegotiation for our last season or two. But one of the things, Julia, Michael, and I were not allowed to participate in syndication as owners, which has since become more or less a successful cast can. But we were locked out, and we thought, well, this thing is going to make so much money, and we're not going to ever see that payday. So we did all this research, and we found out that NBC was making $14 million of profit per episode. So we said, well, I guess we can go hog wild. Let's ask for $1 million each an episode. I mean, they got it. You know, I'd rather not take it out of production. I'd rather take it out of profit, but they're not going to let us. So we did, and we made that ask, and NBC was, as you can imagine, reluctant. So it went very, very slowly, very, very slowly. And it started to get to critical mass where they had to announce the new season. We didn't have a deal, you know, and they had to announce their schedule. So all of a sudden things were happening quickly. And I won't name names, but they asked us all to get on a phone because we were going to hear an offer that was going to blow our minds. And we got on the phone, and again, I will not name names, but it was, you know, it was NBC, some brass. And they said, here's our offer. So we had asked for $1 million an episode. They were now up to 175,000. Right. We were still pretty far apart.
Yeah.
And they said, here's our offer. We're going to give you each 250,000 an episode. And we're going to give you 100,000 shares of GE stock. But you can't exercise that stock for 10 years.
Whoa.
And the phone is, everybody's silent. So me, smart ass, I go, okay, I can't speak for everybody else. I accept that deal on one condition. We give you the first 13 episodes now, and 10 years from now, we give you the back nine. And that was the end of that.
No, I think, and again, you know, as we talk, did anyone
hang
laugh?
On a second,
was no laughter.
No laughing.
And in fact, I was told, "You really, they are not your friends." I said, "I'm sorry, were they my friends at the start of
you
the
really
call?
Hurt your friendship?
My friends were
yeah, no
you know.
Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving's ruined.
Yeah.
I want to know what that was worth. 100,000 shares of 1997 stock.
Let's see. What year was it? So we started. Yeah, right. 97. Yeah. I guess so.
Yeah. Find out how much GE stock was in 97. Now
I probably made a bad deal.
Yeah.
But what was it in 2007?
What 2007? 2007, look up GE stock.
But you have to now look at the market cap and see how many shares were out there. Because if it's split, it's split.
First of all, you
don't
have
you have that yet?
First of all, you
God
have
damn it,
to,
Katie.
You have to take a course.
Who was in the Elf
Come
movie?
Back. We're going to send you to Barnes & Noble. You're going to go to the finance section. We have a list of 9 books for you to read. then there'll be a written portion.
But, you know, amazing. In retrospect, you go, that really was an incredible offer. I mean, they were thinking out of the box.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, and they didn't want to make the price of television astronomical.
And I also want to, because whenever there's a renegotiation and it goes public and then people go, oh, fucking whiny actor's not getting, you know, what you always say is like, it's the only time people tend to side with a corporation. It's like, that money's not going to an orphanage.
I'll tell you an interesting thing.
Hang on, give me that. I'm going to take your computer. You guys talk for a second.
Here was what was so interesting. So, you know, somebody had put it in the paper what the negotiation was. And I thought, oh, my God, this is going to reflect so badly on us because no one understands what the realities are here, you know. And I was online for a movie in New York, and this Hispanic woman, I guess, in her late 20s comes up to me, and she's got a little scowl on her face, or what I thought was a scowl, and she goes, you're in that Seinfeld show, right? I said, yeah. She goes, you're asking for like $1 million an episode, man? I said, yeah. She went, you go get them, baby. You go get them.
That's so nice.
Well,
I think you know, I think people understand. It's like, you know, if you're the cast, it's basically a profit share. If you're the cast,
well, here's the thing. I went on Charlie Rose, and it was weird because we were in this negotiation, and Charlie Rose asked me to be on the show.
Did he blink? I've never seen him blink.
He's never blinked.
Okay.
And I go on, and you know, he hit me with the question. He goes, "Do you really think you are worth $1 million a week?" And I answered him honestly. I said, absolutely not. I don't think any actor's worth $1 million a week. I don't think I'm worth what they're paying me now. Yeah. If you look at it in the real world, I mean, a teacher should make more than me, a cop, a fireman, a soldier. I mean, there's tons of people who have real value in their work every week that actually change people's lives. I said, but Charlie, I don't live in the real world. I live in this world. This show's going to make $1 billion of profit. It's not coming out of your pocket. It's not coming out of my pocket. Somebody put it there. Someone's going to get it. Who should get it? What part of that $1 billion was due to me and Michael and Julia? Any part? 10%, 5%, 1%? Any part of it?
Yeah, yeah.
And because I said, here's what they've offered us. Zero. So we're just asking for something. And he turned his head around. He went, wow. Well,
we're going to take a break while someone puts bourbon into my eyes.
But it was, you know, it was a crazy time. It was really a little uncomfortable because I think there was some attempt to make the three of us look.
I mean, during the negotiation,
that we actually are.
During the negotiation, during any negotiation, you have to be emotionally okay with the company coming back and going, "Okay, you're no longer doing this." And you have to – so during that, how long did the process last?
We began the renegotiation. Jerry came back after the Christmas break and said, okay, We said we would do more. I made my deal with the network, and I told them, you know, but there's no show unless my people are happy.
Oh, good.
And then we started to negotiate, and, you know, we weren't terribly happy. But so we started negotiating in January, but there was really no movement of any kind until we finished the season, which was early April. And then May 10, they had to announce at the upfronts what their new season was going to be. And on May 8, we didn't have a deal.
Holy shit.
So it was, you know, 6 weeks of, I'm sure, for everybody involved. And by the way, I don't vilify anybody. I think it all happened probably the way it had to happen. But it was really stressful and tense. And we left shooting our season. Nobody knew if we were coming back. I mean, we didn't know what to say to the crew. You know, they were all going, do we have a job next year? And we go, I don't know. The one thing I would say, I would like to think if I had a network or a studio that I would try and do business another way. I know on the few occasions where I've been able to be in a negotiation where we really were able to talk to each other, they always went fine. And you know, more often than not, I decreased my goal, but I understood what the other guy was doing and why. Sure. He was asking for what he was asking for. So it was a very not fun 6 weeks.
Oh, really? when you throw the entertainment lawyers into the mix, the business affairs people, it all changes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
All the creative execs. Well, my manager always makes this joke. He's like, all the creative execs will call and tell you how your client is irreplaceable, and then business affairs makes the next call and tell you how replaceable your client is.
Right. Like,
exactly. So, okay,
I have a question.
What did I lose?
When you were negotiating, was it before May of 1997? It must have been.
He said it started in January. It was before May.
Yeah. Okay. So
the stock offer was probably in April somewhere.
Okay, great. Hang on 1 second.
Oh, Jesus.
I'll tell you.
You're going to break my heart now, aren't you? You could have had.
Hang on. I think you might have done okay. You might have might have done the right thing.
All right.
But let's see. Hang on 1 second. Hang on. Times two. Now in the year 2000, it split 3-1. Times three. Okay. So you. Ooh.
Hit me. Give it to me.
$7. 37 in 2007.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually.
You did fine. Because that would have been worth $22,200,000.
That's what we basically
got.
You did fine.
So it was a wash.
Oh, God. I got real worried for you.
And I had it sooner. In time for the big crash of 9/11.
You would have lost. Yeah, between 2000 and 2007 and now, you would have. That would have dropped down to about 20 million.
Oh, I wouldn't have kept it. Don't worry about it.
Oh, good. You would have immediately been like, I'm out.
I would have been hawking it on the street with cigarettes.
Were you good? Were you good with money in terms of?
No. No, we're fine, but it's not because of me.
No, I mean, were you good in terms of, like, when you get it, or do you, like, do you know what to do?
No.
That's why there are people that
absolutely not
are in your life.
No, the one thing I am good about is I have always lived like an unemployed actor, so I don't buy anything unless I can buy it. I don't buy anything on credit.
Right.
But I went.
I bought nine helicopters with cash.
Now you're going to get the insights. So
I love it.
My wife and I years ago went to a psychic, and I don't know how I feel about this stuff, but this guy actually told us some stuff that was so spot on and so specific. And we went, crap, this is amazing. And he very nonchalantly said, now when it comes to money, never you. You don't make the decision. He said, because if you and I have the exact same stock, and we both are going to sell it on the same day, I'll sell it 3 seconds before you and make a profit, and you'll lose your shirt. You just are not good with making decisions about money, so don't do it. So my wife does it all.
Do you think he said that maybe because women are more likely to pay psychics?
Well, I see where you're going.
Interesting.
I'm picking up
that
what
the psychic would know to say such an amazingly thoughtful thing about the future.
Yeah, yeah. But it worked out very well because my wife does the research and she hires the right people. And other than, you know, we got killed twice. We got killed in 9/11 and we got killed in 2008 when it died again. But But we've always made it back. It's been okay.
You hung in there. It came back. Yeah, you're fine.
That's the thing. It's a long game. Yeah.
That's what they tell me.
If you stick in there, then over time, it's all going to be fine. Yeah, yeah.
They don't account for the fact that, you know, I walk very close to traffic every day. So. But it's all fine. No problems.
I was so delighted to hear that you were not only a fan of Walking Dead, but that you came, that you wanted to come on the show. Geez. When they said, Jason Alexander wants to come on the show, I'm like, really? Like, I don't know.
Just... From episode 4 of that show, I was like a mental patient. I couldn't get enough. It was, there's something that the whole... You know, the underlying, it's not so underlying, that whole theme of if these were your circumstances, what human would you become and how would your values shift and when do you give up and when do you, it's just so intriguing to me watching this group of people and all their dynamics play out this Armageddon scenario and fight for their survival and fight to remain in some way, shape or form human is just being done so well. And what kills me is that the show, I mean, it's a gigantic hit, but within the industry, it does not get a lot of love.
No, not at all, actually. I mean, maybe for special effects, but I look at, you know, for, there are Emmy Award winning performances.
Absolutely.
In that
and
show.
Not only the performers, who are uniformly fantastic, some of them are just given some things to do that are extraordinary. The directing of the show, the writing of the show, the writing on that show, given what it is about, is as rock solid, as imaginative, as potent as Breaking Bad was. The quality of the writing is extraordinary, and it has to be because it's handling so many stories, so many characters. It never gets a writing nod. It never gets a directing nod.
I think it's just that thing of... You know, there are two things that don't typically get respect when it comes to award time, which is horror and comedy.
Right.
And I know American Horror Story has gotten some, but American Horror Story is
it's really a soap opera with some scary stuff.
It is. It's more of like an art piece.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a Picasso painting.
It is. So, you know, horror and comedy just never really get the award respect because I don't know, I guess it's sort of like, oh, those are vulgar art forms. When you know, first of all, good horror is very difficult to do.
Very hard to do.
And good comedy is near impossible to do. Yeah. Like, good comedy is the hardest thing to do. But it still doesn't, you know, it's not gonna get the. And I think that's just sort of the, you know, you sort of just know, okay, well, that's fine. I'm still gonna put on the clown makeup. I'm still gonna, you know.
Yeah, because comedy has its own
little
rewards.
Noses on my sperm.
You know, for the most part, you know, the rock solid comics guys have huge rewards. You know, they get paid very well, and their careers tend to last a little bit longer. But no, that's not a lot of respect for it as an art form.
Were you upset or happy that, spoiler, that Glenn was not dead?
I was on the fence because it is those losses that make it so profoundly watchable.
Yeah.
And the loss of Glenn would have been an immense blow, and it would have enriched the possibilities of so many other characters. By the same token, you love Glenn and you love Steve. I see, at this point, I feel like I'm protective of the actors. Like, oh, sure. I don't want Steve to lose his job. I'm happy to have him there for as long as he's going to be there. But I also thought it was not – here's actually what I thought. I thought if this is it wasn't – they didn't shoot it very well. I didn't feel it.
Because it was so quick and so –
Well, it was quick and it was a weird angle because they had to hide the truth. And,
yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's bizarre. And it didn't have – here's the other thing it didn't have. It didn't have – in some sense, the pullback to Maggie. So you didn't feel that relationship loss. You didn't feel her death in it as well.
Right.
And I thought, if and when Glenn really dies, we're going to reflect it in the eyes of Maggie. And they tried to do that with the following episode. But Tyler's death was so...
Noah.
Powerful, yes. So powerful and shot the way I think when, you know... When Shane went down, when Dale went down, when the characters we've connected with go down, it felt different than Glenn's death. So I was left hanging.
Yeah, because I don't watch ahead. So when that episode happened, I talked to them about it. I talked to Scott about it, and I just said, yeah, it was. I said a similar thing. I was like, well, if he really is dead, it was a very not. It was there was not a lot of fanfare. It was very. Yeah. And he said to me, well, but that's how people die. That's how people die in this world. And then after it was all over, he said, listen, you know, because immediately before the Glenn episode resolved, before it was over, there was people were already posting like, social, yeah. This was, I can't believe they tricked the.
Right.
And Scott said, you know, we wanted the audience to feel what the people in that world felt. Right. You don't know. You don't know. Like, Glenn was out there. Maggie didn't know. The survivors didn't know. They wanted to create that. And I thought, you know, that adds such an extra dimension. And so for people to complain about the writers trying to do something that adds a dimension of uncertainty to everything, yeah. Like, why? What are you fucking complaining about?
Right.
I mean, most people were very happy. I was asking people at my live shows, would you be happy if Glenn was not alive? No, we want Glenn. Course, and I was very happy that he didn't die too. So.
I got to tell you, after I did talking to them, I was chatting with my partner, Peter Tilden, and I didn't know he was a deadhead. I didn't know he watched the show because we had never talked about it, which is so weird because we talk about everything. And he came up with the funniest observation because, you know, having Kirkman right there were so many things I wanted to go,
sure.
Yeah, bud, come on. And he said, so you got 300 zombies coming at you, right? All they want to do is eat the flesh of the living. Six of them get to the guy. Do those six go, you know, I feel much better now. It doesn't seem to matter whether you eat or don't eat. You just keep going and going. Some of them don't even have stomachs anymore. What do they eat? But they'll eat you. It's not for nourishment. What is that all about?
It's like a buffet in Vegas.
I started sounding like Jerry. What the hell
is it? Why do the zombies, do they feel like,
yeah.
Do they pick ethnicity? Sometimes they feel like Asian.
And at what point do they stop eating?
They don't.
No, they do. You see zombies walking around that were clearly half eaten. Those people were dead. They started being eaten. And at some point, the zombies went, oh, you know what? This guy's really dead now. I can't.
Maybe they're like,
off.
We could use him amongst
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm watching my zombie figure.
Wild. Yeah. No one ever goes, why? Why the flesh of the living? Why?
Well, because there are two things that you have to accept about the show. Number one, everyone has this virus, and
right.
You're never going to find out what it is.
Right.
And number two, that the characters before this event did not know what zombies were. Because
right.
They don't use the word. They don't. They can't. They're not
right.
Using the. Oh well, the Night of the Living Dead. Like they're not.
Yeah, no, there's no reference.
There's no reference
right.
Point for them. So those are the two main things. And mm-hmm. If you're okay with that, then it's great. And then,
which by the way, still the greatest line ever written. Is in Night of the Living Dead, where they're interviewing the sheriff. You know the line I'm talking about?
Yeah, go ahead.
And the reporter goes, now, Sheriff, if I were surrounded by eight or nine of these things, would I have a chance? And he goes, oh, yeah, yeah. You just, you know, you hit them in the head. You just hit them in the head with something. They're not terribly strong. You know, they're dead. They're all fucked up. He's already casual about it. Nah, it's not. This is not a big deal.
Are you watching Ash vs. Evil Dead? Have you watched Ash vs. Evil Dead?
No, I'm not.
It's really fun.
Is it?
Yeah.
Where is that?
It's on Stars. They brought back Evil Dead with Bruce Campbell.
Oh, okay.
And it's funny.
I have children. I'll get there.
It's really funny. You'll get there's too much.
I just polished off the first season of Daredevil because of that.
Oh, so great. Jessica Jones is great, too. If you like Daredevil, you'll love Jessica Jones.
My kids did not quite groove on the Jessica Jones.
They didn't?
Thing. No.
I grooved on it.
Yeah?
I loved it. There was more, because, you know, Daredevil's great, but it's really just like a crime show.
Right.
I mean, he has abilities, but it's not, there's not so much. And Jessica Jones is really interesting because there's this trend, what it seems to be, with these Netflix comic book, these Netflix Marvel shows where they're trying to bring in more true crime realism and like so the powers are a little, whereas like a network show that would be front and center.
Supergirl,
exactly. This is sort of like they,
which I am watching it.
You're like Supergirl, yeah. They have powers, but it's not, you know, they it's
right,
not as
right.
Front and center
yeah,
as everything
yeah, yeah,
else.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah,
sort
yeah.
Of an oh by the way,
yeah, absolutely.
But I really dug Jessica Jones.
Luke Cage in it.
Luke Cage is in it.
Awesome.
Wow.
Yep.
Who's playing Luke Cage?
I don't know the actor's name, but he's
quick.
He's fantastic. Whoever the guy is who's playing Luke Cage is fantastic.
Really?
He's really good because they're doing a Luke Cage standalone series.
I'm going to ask you an inopportune question because I know you kind of work for the camera.
Hmm.
You got any feeling about Into the Badlands?
No. I don't have a feeling about it because I haven't watched any of it. Uh-huh. I haven't watched any of it yet because when I'm in Walking Dead mode, I'm basically just in Walking Dead mode.
Yeah.
So
I'm not Mike sure about Culkin. It. Yet. I can't.
Coulter?
Mike Coulter. Mike Coulter,
Mike,
you are
doing a great job. I look forward
to watching
you.
You are fan-fucking-tastic as Luke Cage.
I wasn't going to watch Jessica Jones, but now Luke Cage.
You know, everyone's great on Jessica Jones. And also, yeah, they are doing Luke Cage Sandler series.
Great.
Kristen Ritter's great, and Rachel Taylor is great, and David Tennant is...
David Tennant is phenomenal. Yeah.
He is just phenomenal. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. As we're sort of winding down here, when you've gotten to do a lot of really neat, fun stuff. Is there a thing that's, you know, whether it's SNL or maybe it's Seinfeld or maybe it's not, or maybe it's something that no one ever saw? Like, what was your favorite thing? Do you have a favorite thing that you go, oh.
A favorite thing?
Do you have kind of a favorite thing? Even if it's a concept of a thing or just
or a McDLT commercial.
Or a McDLT commercial that you might have done.
You mean of the stuff that I've done?
Of anything that you've done, yeah.
There's one that I think, well, it's really hard to have anything top Seinfeld. Only because it lasted so long, it has this enormous fascination for people still, which I can't account for, and it was a complete joy from top to bottom. Even the days, you know, in the negotiations that were rough, the work, the being with the gang, being on the stage and making the shows was just a laugh fest, a love fest, nothing better. And, you know, a series is an arranged marriage. You don't know what you're getting. You put four people together and you go, they may not get along. I've been on sets where there's a little bit of rancor. And we were just extraordinarily lucky. So it's hard to top that. But of all the stuff that I've done, the one that I was scared by and thought this could really prove how not worthy I am was a small indie movie of a Broadway play called Love, Valor, Compassion.
Oh, yeah. I know this. I know this movie.
And it was – so it's a small movie about the lives of seven gay men who are friends and some of them have relationships over the course of a couple of summers. And it was during the height of the AIDS epidemic. And it was the play won the Pulitzer and it won all kinds of awards. And they made the movie with the original cast, the theater cast, minus Nathan Lane. Nathan had done The Birdcage, and for whatever reason, he decided he couldn't follow it up with Love, Valor, Compassion. And so I got invited to that party, and it was scary on a number of levels. One was these other actors had lived with it, you know, eight shows a week for well over a year. I mean, they knew this piece in a way I just was never going to catch up with. And it was also... a character so far removed from me, a flamboyant gay man dying of AIDS. And I thought, this is going to be so easy to be a caricature or, you know, a cartoon, and I'm going to offend the gay community, and, you know, it's a piece that's so important to that community. And the whole thing turned out to be just a joyous thing to work on. And the response that I got from the gay community for doing the film was beyond imagining. And I look at that film and I go, that's pretty good. That, you know, I hadn't done a dramatic piece of work for a while when I did that film, and I went, okay, those muscles are still in there. That's pretty good.
Does it make you miss that? Because when you hear doing like eight shows a week for 8 years, mm-hmm. and when it's year seven and you're doing the same show that you've done eight.
Well, I've never done eight a week for 8 years. I mean, but I've done eight a week. The longest I've ever done eight a week was 14 months. And
how do you keep it fresh month 11?
It's extremely hard. Honestly, it's extremely hard for me at that point. I know people that do shows for years and years and years, and they're totally happy to be doing it. I'm good for about 6 months. And after that, unless something unusual happens, like if new cast members come in and you go, ooh, I got to adjust, that can freshen it up for a while. But when you sign a Broadway show deal, you're basically signing for a year. So that's eight a week for a year. And what people don't realize who don't do it, because you think, oh, come on, he's working 2 hours a night. What's the big deal? No big deal. That's true, but your entire life has to gear for those 2 hours. So you can't expend energy. You can't use your voice. If it's a musical, you really can't use your voice. And you have to explode at that 8 o'clock hour. So you turn your life upside down. And I was back on Broadway this summer doing Larry David's play. Same thing. I friends would call and go, hey, let's go out after the show. I go, can't. Can't do it. I won't have anything for tomorrow. but after about 6 months, the material, it's hard to be feeling and hearing and seeing the material with a fresh eye that night. You kind of go, here's the laugh, here's that moment, here's this thing, here's that, oh, they're going to do this now. And it does, it gets into a little bit of a rut. There is a freshness that happens with the audience every night. And it sustains we theater actors to at least give it our best attempt, because you can feel the fresh, especially on Broadway, where, you know, people come to New York to go to Broadway. It is their it's the highlight of what they're going to do in New York, and they bring that energy into the theater, and it really is a turn on, and you get excited for them, and you want to deliver for them. So they can gear you up, but by the same token, there is such a thing as a dead house.
Oh yeah, yeah, and, yeah. That is also an arranged marriage.
Yeah,
you know what? There's a lot of arranged marriages with a cast. And then the audience is its own arranged marriage, and then those two entities are an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
And there are some audiences where I've heard comics say, like, if you guys ever get a chance to be an audience together again, don't.
Yeah,
you know, it's like some people just have weird energy together.
You bet. And you know, there was an
and sometimes it's the performer's fault, but sometimes it is also the audience's fault.
I always say the audience is never wrong. And usually if the audience is dead, it's something funkadoo is happening on the stage. But by the same token, I was in a show, the one that I won the Tony for was a show called Jerome Robbins Broadway. And it couldn't be a bad night because it's really just a dance show. It's some of the greatest theater dances ever done by the best dancers on Broadway at that time. And I was not one of them. I was like the host narrator of that show. So when I was just showcasing these 60 extraordinary people. West Side Story, you know, I mean, it was just great. And we had an audience just, they couldn't care less. I was like, was this a prison sentence?
Why'd you leave your houses?
Is this community service? What's going on? And I actually, after one extraordinary number, it was a matinee, I turned to the audience as the narrator and went, okay, why don't you look in your playbill? What do you want to see? we'll just do those.
Confound them, or did
it
they?
Did, and I was harshly rebuked for doing that.
Well, see, that's the problem. That's what when you have a little bit of the comedian gene.
Yeah,
you can't,
it's hard
help
to
it.
Not respond, yeah. Especially when you're talking right to them. It's hard to not.
And I'm not going to make you tell the whole story again. But so anyone who should watch Misery Loves Comedy, which is Kevin Pollak's movie, where you tell a whole story about that. I think it was that
story.
No. You tell a different story about the comedy gene going wrong for you because you came out
at the SAG Awards.
Where you
God. Oh.
I don't want to make you read that again.
That was so not good. Yeah. I have never forgotten that. I mean, that must be what it feels like. It's two things I hadn't really known. One was, you know, really bombing with something. But also public humiliation is
right.
Just a bad thing. <It's> a good thing. For the Jews. We don't like it. it's just, Jew! You hear the whole one is going, Jew!
No!
You know, that was rough. That was rough. And with the best of intention, but it just didn't.
Yeah, comedy is always with the best of intentions, but when there is a swing and a miss, you're like, that's not, no, don't, stop running, sit down, I didn't mean
that. Yeah, I do a line, I still do it in my stand-up, because I talk about how goofy I think tattoos are, and I talk about it being a relatively new phenomenon, tattoos. I go, 50 years ago, nobody had a tattoo. If you had a tattoo 50 years ago, you were either a merchant marine or a Holocaust survivor.
Right.
And that, with the wrong crowd, I go, ooh. And I go,
right.
Really? Too soon? What are we, you know?
It's just a fact.
They tattooed the people with Holocaust, you know. It was
I'm one of you. Right. What are you?
I can do that, Joe. That's right.
Remember that curve?
My real name is Greenspan. Don't be fooled by this Goyish name.
What if you're like, no, it's okay. I can do that joke. I'm anti-Semitic. What?
There's the Bryan Cranston episode.
There's the Bryan Cranston. Yeah.
There's an episode of Curb where Larry gets Jeff to hire this chef because he has all these numbers on his arm and he thinks he's a Holocaust survivor. So he's like, hire this guy. He's the survivor. Uh-huh. And then, like, and find out that he's like rubbing it off with his lottery numbers that he wrote down on his arm.
Well, Jason Alexander, you've been amazing for the past hour, and
God bless you, Christopher.
I believe we're promoting Grindr for you. Is this correct?
Well, the two episodes that I've done have aired. They tell me I'm coming back, but I don't understand how. But okay.
We cannot wait to
see
you.
There's a way.
They tell me that, because, you know, I'm the director, creator of the show that Rob used to be on.
Right.
Which he's no longer on. So why am I still?
You know, there's
up,
always I, you know, a television way to weave.
You know, when you've got magic like this, you find a way to do a magic show.
It can't be contained. Magic just happens, you guys.
But where will I be? What am I doing? You look for me at your local. I don't do comedy clubs, but I do big theaters.
The theaters, yeah, the tour. That's fun. That's really great.
Symphonies,
I'm so glad you're doing that.
Yeah, it's all going to be great.
And also, Jason Alexander returning to television with Alf is another thing that we established.
Hey, plug my kid. Tell people to check out on YouTube. Go to Idiot Chimney. Idiot Chimney.
Go to Idiot Chimney.
My
and see
son,
James.
Gabe Greenspan, kept his real name.
Nice.
Don't know why. Not a good choice. I don't think. I kept saying to him, not a good choice. Yeah, but he and his partner are doing some very funny sketch stuff. On.
Where did Alexander come from?
My father's first name.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Alexander Greenspan.
But I was going to be Jason Scott because my real name is Jay, not Jason, Scott Greenspan.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought, Jason Scott. And I had to join my first union, and they said, would you like a stage name? I said, Jason Scott, please. And I was 13 or 14, and they went, nope.
What do you mean, no?
And so we got 10 of them on every possible spelling. I tried spelling Jason, J-A-I-S-I-N, Jason, like raisin. They went, no, we got it. Somebody took it. I went, oh, fuck.
Hello, Jason Scott the 10th
so,
here.
Yeah, just sitting there going, oh, my dad's name is Alexander, Jason Alexander. And they went, yeah, sure.
And you didn't want Greenspan? Why?
Only, I think it was just an age thing. I was, a fat, shy kid. I got picked on every day.
Yeah.
And Greenspan was just green fill in the blank. Green shit. And I just went, I don't want it on the marquee. They're going to make fun of it.
Is that funny? It's just like, that no matter, you know, most of your life is basically just making up for stuff that happened between the ages of 12 and 17.
But what a world we live in where, you know, Jesse Eisenberg, you know, it's fantastic. If I had come into a real career later, I probably would have got my name.
So Gabe Greenspan, Idiot Chimney.
Yeah.
Jason Alexander. Where are your dates listed, your live dates?
Nowhere.
Okay.
No. I don't like really having attendance.
Sure.
We'll talk after we record, but I think you're doing something wrong.
Okay.
So so if you just show up to a theater, Jason Alexander might be there doing stand-up.
I might be there.
Check your local
marquee. But you don't know.
No, you have no idea.
But he is Jason Alexander on Twitter.
Post it there.
You do post it there. Okay, excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Jason Alexander.
Good luck with your life and career. You're a fine young man.
I appreciate
highly of you.
I am so honored. Thank you so much. I feel weird now, and I'm smiling and I'm blushing at the same time.
You can't make eye contact. That's very funny.
I can't.
Is that true? You can't take a compliment?
I take it okay.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I'm okay.
You're in on yourself.
No, I'm fine. It's good. It's good. I mean, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Cannot wait for your wedding.
Oh, next year. Shut up. Sit down.
Yeah.
I know. My fiance is so wonderful, and every day we wake up, and she's like, I love waking up to you every morning, and I'm just like, shut up. You know. And she's like, no, I will never shut up. Like, I can't. Even from my own fiance, I'm like, stop, please.
What is that about? Because there's something to that.
You know, it is. It's probably a bit of self-loathing, and it's probably a bit of I don't deserve that, and it's probably, you know, I too was mercilessly picked on in grade school, and so I think there's always just a, and then I think there's also some of it is probably like, oh, if I allow that, then I'm an asshole. Oh, you know what? Fuck it, Catholic guilt. That's what it is.
Oh yeah,
Catholic guilt.
See, it's the only thing to rival.
My mother
Jewish
did
guilt.
A thing to me when I was in high school, because I really was the kid that was not getting any love, and then I started acting, and kids responded to me very nicely. And I had done a show in high school, and my mother was backstage with me for whatever reason, and you know, the umpteenth person went, "Hey, you were great!" And instead of going, "Thank you, really, thank you," I just went, "I know." And my mother heard that, and she pulled me over to the side, and she said, if I ever hear you respond like that to somebody complimenting you again, you will never be on a stage again.
Oh, my gosh.
And it so got to me that to this day, you know, when anybody comes up to me and they say, oh, I really like your work, all I can do is just kind of – I have the same thing. I kind of go, oh, thank you. That's
thank
very
you.
Sweet.
That's
thank
very
you.
Nice. Yeah.
No, I don't know how to quite
– yeah,
because I'm always worried anything other than, you know – deepest humility.
You're welcome.
Going to be an asshole.
And I had the most supportive parents in the world, and I still feel like, I still just feel like, oh, yeah, you know, I mean,
yeah.
which is kind of funny as a comic where you think there are shades of it's not so much narcissism, but definitely like you're egocentric as a comic because you're expressing your point of view is so important that you have to get on stage in front of strangers and seek validation. But I get all weird and blushy about it, and then at a certain point, then you look like more of an asshole because they're like, oh, he's faking the. But it isn't. I do feel like
everything.
I can feel my.
No matter what you do, we're going to judge.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, just live your life.
I'm a piece of shit. Oh, what? I'll just leave.
Oh, look
that.
At this guy. He's got to be so low.
Oh, he's got to be so.
So what am I supposed to be now? Yeah, that's how people are going to react. Oh, he has to be the. He claimed the piece of shit territory. So.
I'm a pile of shit. Oh, a whole pile, huh? Boy, this guy.
That's like Louis C.K. suck a bag of dicks.
A whole bag of dicks. Well, it's good to see you, man.
Thank you, sir,
so much for being here. And
we'll
enjoy your burrito, everyone. That was almost Alf-like. Alf! The dark Alf comedy is coming back.
Scout has just laid there.
Yeah. The dog, Katie's dog, doesn't ever.
Just if I could lick my balls, maybe I, too.
All day long.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Rhea Seehorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.